You're listening to Thrive, where every week we have meaningful conversations with incredible women like you, packed with practical tips and sisterly advice to bring you from a life of simply surviving to thriving. We're shaking the story that you're just getting by and stepping into who God made you to be. Because it's not enough to simply survive, you deserve to thrive. I'm your host, Erica Gwynn, and I'm ready to thrive together. Here's today's episode. Hey friends, and welcome back to Thrive. We know I love me a good faith-based scientist. We love faith, we love science, but we know that in this world, it often feels like the two conflict more than they come together. Dr. Lauren Gilbert is our guest on the show today, and she's got some words on that. If the idea of authenticity and what it means to live your most authentic life, both on and offline nowadays, is something that you've been considering, you are going to love this conversation. We talk about what it is, but also what it is not, and how to live in the gray area of truly embracing where you are right now while always aiming to improve without oversharing along the way. We also break down the pursuit of happiness and trade it for something even better, the pursuit of meaning. Stay tuned through this episode, drop it 5 stars if you like what you're listening to. And now, welcome Dr. Lauren.
Hi, thank you so much, Erica, for having me.
Yay, hey Doc, welcome to Thrive. I am so particularly stoked about this conversation because here at Thrive, we love practicals. And we were talking about this briefly before we hit record. We really love looking at life through both a faith-based lens and a science-based lens, or a science-backed lens. And that's exactly what you do. You look through both as a psychology PhD, studying and researching and writing about how we can live more authentic lives that bring us more joy, more passion, more purpose in our everyday life without shying away from the hard stuff, because I think that's kind of like the very important asterisk to caveat everything here. So from your mouth to our ears, tell us more about you, what you do, and why you do it.
Great. I got my PhD in psychology following undergraduate, and I taught as an assistant professor in Nashville at a private liberal arts Christian college for 3 years. And then I decided I kind of felt pulled away from that for a little while, and I took some time off and I stayed home with my kids. And during that time, I felt like God was really leading me to kind of embrace this dual nature. I had spent the vast majority of childhood really focused on faith and even considered kind of going to theological seminary or something at a certain point. And then I became very science dominant in my thinking. And as I took this time away from academia, I really felt pulled that, you know, as humans, we really have this dualistic nature of our own beings. We have this compulsion to seek higher meaning, to seek God, to believe that we're all connected, to believe that, you know, there is more to life. But then there's also the practical tools that psychology offers us about how to live a more meaningful life and how to handle challenges that come up and how to navigate hard relationships. And I really felt that kind of this interweaving of science and faith for me felt really healing. And so I started thinking and reading in these different domains and putting this together myself, because there's not actually been historically a lot of people who have tried to navigate both worlds. In fact, I think the church a lot of times feels very antagonistic about science. There's a lot of trepidation about, you know, what do we embrace with science? And then you have a lot of science folks who are quite anti-religion. And so finding people that are willing to kind of have one foot here on earth and the science aspect of things, then also one foot in, you know, the future of heaven and just in the religious aspect of our nature, is there's just not many. So it's been challenging. It's been so exciting. I'm just taking it one day and one step at a time.
For sure. And you're absolutely right. It's like, it feels like it's two separate worlds, and there's so little overlap that we see. It's like a Venn diagram that doesn't actually intersect. So if we are thinking of it as a Venn diagram, though, especially since now so much of what you do is kind of finding that sacred middle ground, where do you think you've seen kind of the most intersection, or like where do you think there's the potential for the most intersection to maybe, whether that's like letting more faith-based people see, okay, here's where to kind of start with good intersection of science, or vice versa, where there's room for them both to kind of play together and both have truths.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I think when we start thinking about a flourishing life, you really see them intersect with one another. Like if it is a Venn diagram, I see them, you know, overlapping quite extensively, because actually science says a lot of the same things that the Bible has always told us about rest, about community, about gratitude. I mean, the more I dug into the Bible post-graduate school and post-academia, I actually began to see through now this new scientific lens that so much of what God asked of us, you know, wasn't based in science back then. We didn't know the science that we do now, but all of those things are for us and for our betterment. And science has actually echoed so many things that God told us, you know, forever ago. And so it's been really, really neat. To me, it's been very strengthening for my faith, because suddenly I see people who shouldn't have known, they wouldn't have known the science, but they shouldn't have known that these things were good for us. These were countercultural in the moment, but that now science has come back and said, there is legitimacy in gratitude. There is legitimacy in rest, in community, in prayer, in meditation. And so it's been so neat. And it's a really fun place to be, because every day I'm finding new things.
Yeah. Not to put you on the spot, but do you have any specifics that you can think of off the top of your head that are maybe like from the Bible that are backed, or like the first couple ones that you remember finding or seeing where you were like, whoa, what a connection? Because I love the visual of that too, where you're like, okay, this story here talks about X, Y, Z, and this is where in science it backed it up. And all of a sudden it could have been like thousands of years later and a dot was connected, and it puts like two and two together for us.
Yeah, you know, so there's this really interesting article I started reading a couple of months ago, and I have to say, I haven't gotten a chance to finish it. I've got two little kids and a full-time job, but, you know, one of my favorite passages from the Bible is perfect love cast out fear. And there's some really interesting psychology research that suggests that love and community and support and comfort can't really coexist with fear in our minds. So when we are loved fully, and you know, we can't perfectly love one another because we're human, right? But when we are in community and we feel fully supported and we feel very seen and known and loved, it actually does decrease anxiety so significantly. In fact, I think one of the most overlooked factors that can actually improve anxiety and improve fear that I wish as a culture we were talking about more is actually kind of this antidote of community. And so the research has shown that when people are isolated or they don't feel seen, they can maybe be in a room filled with people, but they don't feel connected to those people, that fear and anxiety are so much higher. And so, you know, the research article I was reading said that the way the brain processes love, it cannot process fear in the same moment, in the same experience, because in reality, love is this kind of antidote to fear. So that's one. Oh my gosh, there's everything. I mean, gratitude's another good one. I like to talk a lot about gratitude because I had a professor in graduate school who was not a Christian, but he would require that all of the graduate students, when they sent him an email, that they signed their name at the bottom and then they wrote five things that they were grateful for, because the research on gratitude is so astounding. When you are actually focused on looking for things that you are thankful for, you see more things to be thankful for. And so over time, your perspective shifts and you become happier, and gratitude actually begets gratitude. So you become more thankful over time. There's some really good research on rest and the importance of rest and the Bible. You know, one of the first commands given to us in the law is to honor the Sabbath and to keep it holy. And so, you know, taking a day off or 2 days off is so critical to our productivity, to our happiness, to our thriving. I mean, time and time again, I could go on for ages and I won't, but there are so many things that overlap that God has told us that science is coming out now and saying, you know, they won't say like, oh, you know, God said this and he was right. But they're saying, yeah, gratitude's a big deal. And love is casting out fear. And, you know, rest is so important. So.
Well, and you're right. Even if people from, you know, the world or secular society won't acknowledge that it's God, I think it's safe to say that for those of us who are believers and we believe the Bible is capital T truth, we can see the writing on the wall that the truth will set us free and that's the truth. So it's kind of like, we know it to be true based on the nature of what we believe. So it's just kind of cool, even if others won't acknowledge that they think it's capital T truth, whatever you want to call it. We know, we can have that little thing in the back of our brains. Like, yeah, we know.
Absolutely. And, you know, honestly, I struggled with my faith for a number of years, and it was actually research in psychology that eventually kind of led me back to my faith, because
no way.
Everything I was reading was evidence for what I had learned growing up. And so I think psychology research can be evidence for your faith, which is wild. But, you know, St. Augustine said, if all truth is God's truth, then learning truth leads us to God. You know, all paths of truth lead us to God. And that is what I have found to be true in my own walk, in my own now career and what I'm doing.
And I think an important caveat to that too is a phrase that I personally am not a fan of in today's society is like your truth. And for anyone who can't see us, I just put little air quotes around that. Because I think that by its very nature implies that there are multiple things that are true that might be inherently at odds with one another. And by its very nature, that just is impossible. So I think it's important to acknowledge that, like, I think it's important to acknowledge, but also an act of humility when we're able to seek out capital T truth and be willing to be wrong and be willing to seek out something almost from that like scientific perspective. When you think about, I don't know, doing any sort of scientific experiment or like the scientific process and just being able to say, okay, if something is true here, what is it? And maybe I don't currently acknowledge it as being true, or maybe it's not right now true to me, but that doesn't mean that it is not at its very nature or at its very core, the truth. So I just think that's like a little aside to throw in since that's such a hot topic in society today.
No, and I love that. And one of the things that I love about science is that science is so, it's a self-correcting system. So we never get so confident in our certainty that we quit looking. And that, you know, it's a very, I think, for most scientists, it's a very humbling process, because something that we believe to be true right now, we may find, especially in the behavioral sciences, isn't actually true when we look at it a different way in 2 years. And so I think it's really important that we acknowledge the process of growth and change and approximation of truth, because truth, capital T truth, it is a process to get there. And will we ever fully know it on the side of heaven? Probably not. But the process of moving in that direction and humbly seeking out what is true is also very thrilling, right? And it keeps us in the right state to remain humble. And it kind of, it encourages me to be humble in my beliefs in kind of all domains. Like what I believe about the Bible today, is it fully true? Or am I going to interpret that same passage differently in 3 years or even tomorrow? You know, so.
Yeah. Okay. So we know so much of what you do is helping others live authentically through both that scientific research and the Bible. So besides also kind of taking into account people's personal reflections, all of that jazz, can you kind of paint the picture of what this looks like in practice to live authentically? Because that's also kind of a buzzword that we hear all the time, like being authentic, and why you think it's so important to kind of combine all of the above, the science, the Bible, people's personal beliefs, all of that, to kind of have that one step closer to this is my truest, best, authentic self.
So authenticity is definitely a buzzword, right? And coming into the sphere is a tricky one because we don't actually have a good definition for authenticity when we throw it around in our culture. Psychology's done some research on it, and we've got some good, you know, relatively good definitions on it. So when I think about authenticity through a scientific framework, I think about acknowledging kind of where we are in the current moment. So acknowledging strengths and weaknesses, and not just knowing thyself. So know thyself is one thing, but taking responsibility for ourselves, which is really key. I think culture tends to throw around like know thyself, but we forget the be responsible for thyself aspect. So taking responsibility for ourselves and then acknowledging that where we are today doesn't have to be where we are 2 weeks from now or 2 years from now. And I think that that's the message of the Bible, right? I mean, we can't fully take on grace and grow in our sanctification if we are so out of touch with the sinner that we are and the struggles that we have. You know, psychology says that you can't grow as a person if you don't have self-awareness to who you are now, which is one of the reasons why we encourage people to go to therapy. Because for one thing, you have this more objective observer who can help you gain self-awareness. Because with self-awareness, compassionate self-awareness and curiosity comes growth and transformation. And so, and I think that that's really the message of the Bible. Like Jesus died for us and we say, you know, our sins are forgiven, but Paul says, you know, you don't have to stay there. You need to try to improve, to grow, to become sanctified, acknowledge who you are, and then lean into God and be transformed in that space and become different. So, you know, authenticity is this sense of it's, you know, you're kind of straddling the line of contentment with where you are, like acceptance of where you are, but an acknowledgement that you still have growing to do. And so when I think about authenticity, this can be in almost any domain. So you can think about authentic emotional expression or emotional experience, rather. So acknowledging how you feel in the moment, it can be authentically accepting your needs in any moment. So I think as moms, for instance, this is really challenging, right? I mean, I have gone, since my oldest was born, I have missed more meals. I have missed more of my own bathroom breaks. I have missed more hours of sleep, you know, and so I think it's important, though, to actually acknowledge what it is that we need and try to fill those needs. We have hunger cues for reasons and thirst cues for a reason. And, you know, we feel sleepy for a reason because God designed us to require food and to require water and to require rest. And so authenticity is listening to your needs and responding accordingly. Authenticity is accepting your failures and your mistakes. But I also think it's accepting your strengths and the things you do well, because when you can authentically identify the giftings that you have from God, then you can lean into those and you can say, you know, God gave me this as a gift to the world, as my job here on earth. And I can use this to help people, but we have to actually authentically accept what our gifts are. And maybe in this case, our passions and our callings, we have to be able to do that as well. And so, authenticity is sometimes, you know, saying no. It has to do with boundaries, and boundaries is another buzzword, but acknowledging that sometimes we give to others and then sometimes we say no because we need to give to ourselves or we need to give that time to God. Just like Jesus sometimes told the crowds that he was done, you know, he was like, okay, that's enough. And he goes off into the wilderness to pray, or he falls asleep on a ship. You know, we have to, authenticity requires that we know when when our needs need to be met and when, you know, we need to call it quits for a little while and rest.
Yes, I love that you called that out, that authenticity is also accepting authentically your gifts from God, because I feel like with it being such a buzzword, it often has the opposite connotation where it's presented as, okay, if you're being authentic, that means everybody is seeing your dirty laundry, so to speak. And it means like, it's all the bad stuff. It's like, it implies that we're like hiding, throwing all of our stuff in a closet, and authenticity is like opening up your shame room or like opening up your closet and being like, here's all my junk.
Yes.
So I love that it's also that you call out, it's like, no, it's also at being not necessarily in a prideful way, but it's like you said, it's accepting the gifts that God has given you for what they are. And then it's using them for His glory. And that is authentic. And God wants us to do that. Like, He gave you a gift for a reason. He wants you to use it. If He just gave it to you and you left it unwrapped sitting under your Christmas tree, you'd be the jerk.
Right. So, that's exactly right. I love that.
Right. Like, it's, we can accept that and lean into it and live it. And that is authenticity. Like, that's, oh, I love that you called that out, because that is important. And that's not, I actually don't know if I've ever actually heard someone say that, where you had the permission slip of like, here you go, you can actually lean into your gifts too, not just the not so pretty stuff.
Yeah, you know, I think the church seems to, I don't know, as a culture, church culture tends to think that leaning into your giftings or acknowledging your giftings is inherently prideful or sinful. And I don't think it's that at all. I think it is you saying, you know, this gift came from God. And it is a gift from Him, but therefore I have responsibility to use it. And so I need to know what it is. Another point though, Erica, I wanted to say is, I think that authenticity also gets a bad rap because we believe that we need to show our dirty laundry to everybody. And we have to be careful about that, right? Because yes, we have these needs and we have these emotions, but let's be honest, we don't have to share those with everybody. Authenticity also is acknowledging who in your life is safe to share what with. And so, you know, a safe community is the only place to be sharing really hard, challenging emotions, challenging life situations. It's not just walking down the street and being like, when somebody asks how you are, like unloading on them, right? That's not authenticity. But I do think that sometimes, you know, TikTok culture or Instagram culture makes it sound like, you know, you show up and you walk in every room and you say, here I am, you know, accept me for who I am. Here's my authentic expression. But authenticity requires discernment and determining who the people and in what situations are required. So if I walk into, you know, if I go home or I meet a colleague at work, because I forgot to mention I'm a lecturing professor. But if I meet a colleague at work and I've been having a really bad day and I say, you know, how are you? And I'm really waiting for them to ask me how I am so that I can kind of unload something that I'm really struggling with. But then I see that they are having a hard time. Sometimes authentic expression is not after they've told me that they've had a really, really bad morning. Maybe they got in a car accident on the way to work or something. I don't then unload on them all of my stuff. Sometimes it's stepping back and saying, you know, the right time for this is not right now. Maybe that's the right person, but this may not be the right time. So we do have to balance. There's still a sense in which we have to balance social obligation and we have to balance what's socially appropriate. And there are places to be more authentic and situations to be more authentic in than others.
For sure. For sure. I'm curious your thoughts on this, because I kind of have always hated the phrase fake it till you make it, because I think it implies there are like pieces of ourselves that should be ignored or maybe hidden or even like twisted in some way to get where we want to go. And I just can't shake the feeling that at its core, it does us and really others a huge disservice, because A, it doesn't necessarily address those pieces. And B, it implies that those pieces are inherently a hindrance in getting to where we want to go. And I feel like living authentically and honestly, the pieces that we might see as being broken or not ready or whatever sort of negative spin we've put on it, they might end up being kind of the missing pieces of our puzzle that make this full picture clearer and maybe what helps us get there in the end, wherever it or there is, like that end point that we're trying to get to. Or it might be what helps our story be relayed better to other people, or it might be the thing that turns our mess into a message, whatever you want to call it. So I'm curious your thoughts on this, because I feel like we're probably on the same page here.
Yeah. So in the New Testament, I love that it talks about in 1 Corinthians, it talks about the church as being like a body, and that it is made up of different parts. And it talks about a hand and talks about an eye. And, you know, I love those verses because it just reminds me that we each have a really important part to play. And yes, that some things that we think of as being weaknesses could actually be strengths. So when I wrote an article about this not too long ago, and I was thinking in terms of, like, for example, the eye and the knee. So the knee is very, very tough. So if you fall on it, it's no big deal. You know, with my little kids, you put a Band-Aid on the boo-boo and, you know, you go on. But an eye can suffer pretty serious damage if it is hit in any way. But, you know, what's interesting is one of the reasons that the eye is so fragile is so that it can fulfill its role as the eye. The eye wouldn't be able to see with the organs that are required and the lens that is required and the way that our vision system is set up. You cannot have the eye be as tough of a body part as a knee and still fulfill its function. And so, you know, one thing I talk to my students about, there's a kind of a personality type now that we've been talking about lately in psychology, and they're called highly sensitive people. And these may be people who I would consider myself a highly sensitive person. They experience emotions more strongly than others. They're more empathetic. You know, even the feeling of clothing on their skin, sometimes they're more sensitive than others. Sights and sounds, maybe they get overstimulated by the end of the day. And, you know, what's fascinating about these highly sensitive people is that my students struggle with the fact that they are highly sensitive if they fall into the HSP, highly sensitive person category. They say, you know, it's frustrating because, you know, I have these really low lows, but I have these really high highs, and, you know, people don't feel things like I do. But so it feels like a liability, but the research has actually shown that these people are remarkable. These people are often more creative. These people are often more compassionate. These people are the people that turn into being therapists, or they're brilliantly creative CEOs, or they're artists. And their highly sensitive nature is, you know, another buzzword that's said is a superpower, but it actually is a superpower. Researchers will refer to this type as orchids, because it takes a little bit more to help them grow and thrive. You know, more perfect proportions of water and sunlight, but they are just so brilliant when they bloom. And those aspects of them are not liabilities. They're actually something that we all benefit from. And so, you know, I love coming in and saying, like, no, if you're highly sensitive, that's amazing. Here's all the things you're really good at, and here's why we need that aspect of you. And so, yes, I think that those things that feel broken and they feel like liabilities a lot of times can actually serve really important functions. Now, you know, that is not to say that there's not room for improvement, right? If there's something that we feel called to, we can acknowledge where we are. And you know, I struggle with the fake it, you know, fake it till you make it phrase, because I don't like that. Psychology would say probably something more along the lines of practice until it's easy.
Yeah.
Practice until it's easy, because practice creates pathways in the brain. It creates habits. It creates confidence. And so kind of stepping out of where you are right now and practicing a skill, or even, you know, a persona or personality trait that you want to embrace more. Maybe you want to be a little bit more extroverted. Well, you know, going out of your home and like practicing just talking to people, you can get better and better at it over time. You do not have to be the same person tomorrow that you are today. But I don't like the fake it till you make it, because that feels disingenuous. I think it's more practice till it's easy.
I like that much better too. So give us kind of step one, or maybe also step two, step three, of figuring out how to truly embrace where you are right now, hangups and all, and discerning which struggles or which fears or weaknesses should move forward with you versus which should be, okay, we're going to leave that at the door. We're going to intentionally kind of work through that one and try to maybe not bring it with us on our next step on our path forward.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great question, Erica. You know, it really depends on the person. I think there's a sense in which we have to have a little bit more self-awareness. So self-awareness is often kind of that first step. You can do that by going to see a therapist, or you can do that through introspection. You can do that through talking to the people that you're close with and saying, you know, tell me about myself. Like, how do you see me? And kind of getting an outsider's perspective. But I think mindfulness too, as you walk through your day and you say things and you feel things. For me, when I was kind of going through this process of unwrapping what authenticity meant, not just in Christianity, but or in the Christian life, but also in science, I thought of, you know, just this small exercise of even just acknowledging when I'm hungry, like noticing when I'm thirsty and noticing those cues and then being motivated by those cues to take care of ourselves. And that's like, actually, like, if there's a step one, that's like step 0.25, right? Is we in 2023 are so divorced from the things that we actually need and the things that we actually feel that we struggle to actually feel those hunger cues or hear that voice in our head that says, this is what you need. Like, I need rest, or I need to go get away from people for an hour and be calm and quiet. We can't even hear those. So I think the actual first step is learning to listen and hear the things that we need. And that feels like a big task. But when you start small and you start by listening just to the very small, most basic needs that you have, you are practicing the act of listening to yourself and trusting and believing yourself and making decisions with the messages that you are getting. And so again, you know, what do I really need right now? Is a good practice. And for most of us, that's really hard. It sounds simple, but it's so hard. And so that's a really good first step, is this sense of self-awareness. So the second step, I think, would be getting aligned with your values, or getting straight with what your values are. And that can be a little bit challenging for a lot of us. One of the things that I think is helpful when figuring out your personal values, because living a life that's authentic requires living by the values that you hold for yourself. One of the ways that I think we can do this is by noticing the times that boundaries have been crossed. So times we get really irritated with people, or times we find ourselves getting really frustrated or really sad, you know, in those moments, in that reaction, and this goes back to authenticity, acknowledging and remaining curious about our reaction or our feelings in any one moment, you know, saying, why am I feeling like this? Like, where is it coming from? And when we're able to take a small moment and break it down, a lot of times it will show an area in which a value has been crossed, a line has been crossed. And that can kind of help us get a better sense of what our values are. Okay, so let me give you an example of this. So if I ask my daughters to get ready for bed, and then they just take off in all directions and they're hiding in closets, or they're climbing over things, or they're getting toys out. And I find myself getting really, really intensely frustrated about it. If I, in that moment, pause, which I do literally every single night, and I say, you know, why is this bothering me so much? It comes back to one of the things that we value in our home is rest and sleep. And we recognize how important sleep is in health and well-being. And so in that case, a boundary has been crossed because I have laid out rules because I'm trying to get people in bed and they haven't done it. And a boundary has been crossed. I've gotten frustrated. I've noticed that I'm frustrated, and it leads me back to the value. And the value is I prioritize rest in my life and in my family's lives. And so that's another really good kind of foundational step to getting us, you know, to moving us into a life of authenticity. I would say another one is just non-judgment and curiosity with whatever comes up through self-awareness, this practice of self-awareness, you know, noticing our needs. And then step two, you know, getting aligned with our values, getting straight our values. Approaching the things that come up with curiosity and not shame and judgment. And that's another thing that I found about the Bible that was, you know, so healing to me during this period of time when I wasn't in academia. It was that I had been reading a lot on shame. And I realized in psychology, shame is actually not a helpful tool in garnering transformation and change. It actually just keeps people stuck. It makes them small. They feel like there is something innately wrong with them. And so therefore they cannot grow. They cannot change. And I started to think back to the Bible and Jesus, and I realized that shame was never a part of the way he approached his interactions with people. He approached people always with respect and with love and compassion. And, you know, psychology shows that those are actually the ingredients that lead to transformation and to healing and to hope and change. And so, you know, sitting with whatever comes up through our process of self-awareness and our process of, you know, recognizing boundaries and values and approaching that with non-judgment, because identifying it is the first step to then changing it if it's something that we aren't pleased with. But, you know, meeting ourselves with compassion the way we tend to meet others with compassion. Mm. And so I think that that's actually a critical ingredient through the whole process is self-compassion and curiosity, because those are kind of the opposite of shame. Yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, I think we attach a connotation to it sometimes just immediately and subconsciously and without even realizing we're doing it. It's so difficult for us to just objectively make a statement about ourselves or notice something. And I almost feel like it helps to kind of think of it as noticing from a third party perspective, if you're able to kind of zoom out and take more of a bird's eye view on your own life. And almost like talking in third person, I feel like probably helps. But if you're able to kind of look at the situation and just state the facts and leave the feelings out of it, and Absolutely. Then you kind of realize how oftentimes we automatically lump them both together and make a judgment about ourselves while noticing something. So it's like our brain isn't even separating the fact from the feeling because we're just automatically applying our feeling to it. And then that's where it gets confused in our head. And oh my gosh, it almost feels like it's coming full circle, because then that's where something becomes like our truth instead of the yeah. truth, because we have conditioned ourselves to believe something is true or yeah. put some sort of feeling on it. And it's all of a sudden this very emotionally charged thing instead of it being just a simple observation that could go either way, but is not positive or negative. It just is.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have a tendency to create narratives about everything. Yeah. The brain loves narratives. It wants to know why. Why did we act this way? Well, it must mean I'm a bad person. Or it must mean I'm deficient in some way. Or it must mean if my kid acts this way, it must mean that 10 years from now, they're not going to have any friends. They're not going to do well in school. And they're going to live with me the rest of their lives. Or whatever narrative you see parents or you see that we give ourselves are so critical and they're so catastrophic. And if we can just detach ourselves and say, Nope, I'm trying to narrate and storytell on something that is no more complex than this one singular experience, than this one action that I took. Maybe this action is all that there is, and it literally means nothing. Yeah, that's an excellent point, Erica.
Yeah. Well, speaking of meaning also, and like attaching meaning to things, slightly different, but I know everyone talks about the pursuit of happiness. Talk to us about the pursuit of meaning, but more from the positive, more purpose-filled angle of meaning. Because I know I just saw you do this recently, a breakdown of the two on your Instagram. And I think a lot of folks maybe haven't really sat down to separate the two and to really consider, is what I'm chasing happiness or meaning, and kind of where, what that looks like and where they intersect.
So I was reading an article, I guess about a month ago, and it was talking about the cellular profile and the genetic profile of individuals who were seeking out meaning for their lives as their top priority versus those who were seeking out happiness as their top priority. And it was suggesting, so for decades now, we have known that people who have had more positive life experiences have healthier cellular and genetic profiles. Somebody, for example, who has experienced chronic adversity is going to have more inflammatory markers, et cetera, in immunological issues, et cetera. But what they were showing was that people who chase after meaning in their lives have lower levels of inflammation. They have immune systems that are healthier. But people who chase after happiness have this profile that we tend to think about when we think about people who have experienced chronic adversity. Their inflammatory markers and their immune system functioning was compromised to the same extent as people who experience chronic stress and chronic adversity. And this was so mind-blowing to me, because in the year 2023, when all we seem to do is chase happiness and distraction and, you know, moments of like dopamine, right? This pointed me back to God too. I mean, over and over, it's pointed me back to God, because here was science saying what God is saying through the Bible, like seek a life of meaning, because the disciples were thrown in prison. And there's, you know, the verses that say sometimes they didn't know what they were going to wear or what they were going to eat, but they were joyful. And I've always tried to understand that, like, how could somebody live through that and still be joyful? And what researchers are saying about meaning really seems to track with the apostles' experience, in that people who pursue lives of meaning can have difficulties. Like, difficulty is still an innate part of their lives, but they feel better about it. They respond to it better. They integrate it into their meaning. And it kind of just further builds this life of meaning. It's, you know, this happened, but, you know, for the disciples, I was thrown in prison, but I was doing it for Christ. And so therefore the suffering innately has meaning to it, and it makes it healthier when we process it. And so it kind of led me down this rabbit hole, and I've been doing a lot of self-reflection and realizing that it's very easy to fall into the trap of only chasing happiness. And now this article was fascinating because it said that happiness is still important. It's not as if somebody chasing a life of meaning is supposed to not, and, you know, enjoy a sunset, or, you know, have a glass of wine, or eat a nice piece of cake, or go out with friends, or, you know, go to a ball game. It's not saying that at all. It's just saying that when you focus your time and your energy on creating meaning, and then you enjoy things, you know, in the interim, like in your everyday lives, kind of on the way of pursuing meaning, then that's really the ultimate happiness. It's the ultimate health physically. So this changed their health profiles, but also you see lower levels of depression and anxiety. I mean, it's truly remarkable the things that the chasing after a life of meaning can create. And so I've been thinking, like, in every, you know, domain of my life, like, what is the meaning? And this does tie in really well to authenticity, because authentically, you know, identifying your calling again in your giftings and saying, you know, this is what I'm going to pursue because this is what God has put on my heart. But and I'm not going to do it, you know, just for the physical and the mental, emotional benefits, but the fact that those are part of the process is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think it also, it kind of is like, maybe it's something where if you're just pursuing happiness, feeling not happy feels like you're failing, or it feels like it's going against what you're looking for. So it automatically is like, ah, nah, like this isn't right. But if you're looking for meaning, or you're pursuing meaning on this bigger scale, it's almost like you're trying to it's a challenge. Like you're trying to find, okay, where is the good in this? Or even if it doesn't feel good, where is the good? Like what can come from this? So it doesn't necessarily feel like it is directly contradictory to what we are looking for. Mm-hmm. It almost feels like it adds to it. And it's like another mm-hmm. thing to color the greater picture of our lives for good, because we're like, okay, I trust Romans 8:28. And you're like, I know that there's something good to be found here. And now it's up to me to find it. Or it's up to me. Maybe we won't be able to find it ourselves, but it's up to me to know and accept that something good could come from this. And it might not be immediate, and it might not be obvious, but it's there. So it won't necessarily feel like going to a spa or going to Disney World, or like it's not going to feel great right away. But there's just more purpose in that. And if we lean into that, I think it helps us not feel like the world is out to get us, or like everything is horrible. It kind of is like, okay, we know that bad things happen to everybody. No one's immune from it. And if we believe that as true, and we believe that everything has worked together for good in some way, shape, or form, okay, there's two truths. Now we can move forward and be like, okay, I can live my life knowing that it's not all going to be pretty and fun and happy-go-lucky, but there will be still positives in the picture along the way, even when the path is hard. And it just makes it easier. And it doesn't, I don't know, it's easier to move forward with, not necessarily like easier in the hard moments in the middle of them, but.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. It's a stepping stone on the path to becoming. Right. Yeah. Sometimes the hard is an important piece of becoming who we are going to be. But, you know, I have to say, like, when you're in the thick of it, right, just like you said, when you're in the thick of it, and I want to make a note, especially for people who are going through something traumatic. You know, I do not want to belittle that experience. Right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, giving meaning to trauma can help people heal, but it doesn't take away the challenge and the suffering in the present moment. But you know, I have a friend who's a therapist, and she says that meaning making is a key component of her therapy when she helps people recover from trauma. And so, yeah, I think it's really important. You know, the research shows that it's just like you said, people who chase happiness are forever running away from the hard stuff. You know, even the little day-to-day things that are bothersome, they're running away from it because they're running towards happiness. But people who are creating a life of meaning can recognize that, you know, sometimes the unpleasant things actually help us become who God wants us to be.
Yeah.
To create a more fulfilling and authentic life.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's probably important to add to, kind of going off of what you just said, even for those of us, like I myself am a big meaning maker. Like anytime I've had a therapist or mentor or anyone, they always have to kind of catch me on that. Cause sometimes I think we try to place meaning on some things that maybe don't necessarily have meaning. Like, and some, like we try to put things together that are super traumatic or truly make no sense. And maybe that wasn't, like maybe somewhere there was some aspect that had meaning attached to it, but some things just suck. And like
some things, that's right. That's right.
You know, like some things I think it's okay to just acknowledge, like, you know what, we're not even going to try to put meaning behind it. It just sucked.
No, that's exactly right. Like God didn't want it for us. We don't want it for us. Sometimes horrible things just happen. That's exactly.
And sometimes they just happen because we live in a fallen, broken world, and it's not God making it happen, or
that's right,
wanting it to happen, or like God putting us to a test. Sometimes it just happens because that's this side of heaven. That is the world. And
yes, exactly.
That's that's what we've got to go through until we make it to the other side.
But you know what? Just because there's no meaning in that traumatic situation does not mean that there cannot be growth from
yes.
it. So that is a very particular nuance, but I think it's really important to say, because the research on post-traumatic growth is really remarkable. Like there no meaning to your suffering, but you can use it to create future meaning. You can grow through it, even though it wasn't placed there purposefully. You can use it to be, you know, a happier, more grateful, more gracious, more resilient and courageous person on the other side. But sometimes that sort of thing doesn't come until hindsight. A lot of times healing has to take place before we can look back and say, you know, wow, I was able to make something of that mess. God was able to make something of that mess through me, and he never intended it, and I would have never asked for it. I've never dreamed of it, but together he has somehow managed to make something good come of it.
Yeah. So good. Lauren, I want to ask you something we ask everyone to close Thrive, which is, what does Thrive mean to you? And how do you strive to thrive in your own everyday life?
So thriving to me means living in the rhythm that God has created for my life, and giving when it's time to give, but allowing myself to receive and to rest when it is time for those things. Hustling in a sense in ways that I enjoy, but taking the time to rest and play and other aspects. Just living more at ease, I think, is thriving, and living more in my calling for the kingdom down here.
Yeah. Amen to that. Can you tell everybody where they can find you online to connect with you more?
Yes, absolutely. So I am on Instagram at the moment. You can find me at Dr. Lauren Gilbert. And I am in the process of finalizing my website. It should be up soon. It's drlaurengilbert.com. Thank you, Erica, so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Thank you. Wait, before you go, make sure you're subscribed to never miss an episode of Thrive. Drop 5 stars on your way out if you like what you just listened to. And come join the party on Instagram at thrive.podcast to stay inspired and thriving all week long. Thanks for tuning in. It's your time to thrive.